What interested Lord Vetinari right now was the device all by itself on a table in the middle of the room. It looked like a collection of copper balls balanced on one another. Steam was hissing gently from a few rivets, and occasionally the device went blup.
And your lordship?
Vetinari looked around. A hand was waving desperately at him from behind an upturned bench. And something made him look up as well. The ceiling above him was crusted with some brownish substance which hung from it like stalactites. Blup! With quite surprising speed, the patrician was behind the bench. Leonard Aquirm smiled at him from underneath his homemade protective helmet.
"I do apologize," he said. "I'm afraid I wasn't expecting anyone to come in. I'm sure it will work this time, however."
Blup! "What is it?" said Vetinari.
Blup! "I'm not quite sure, but I hope it's a—"
And then it was suddenly too noisy to talk. Leonard Aquirm never dreamed that he was a prisoner. If anything, he was grateful to Vetinari for giving him this airy workspace and regular meals and laundry and protecting him from those people who for some reason always wanted to take his perfectly innocent inventions, designed for the betterment of mankind, and use them for despicable purposes. It was amazing how many of them there were, both the people and the inventions. It was as if all the genius of a civilization had funneled into one head, which was, therefore, in a constant state of highly inventive spin. Vetinari often speculated upon the fate of mankind, should Leonard keep his mind on one thing for more than an hour or so. The rushing noise died away. Blup! Leonard peered cautiously over the bench and smiled broadly.
"Ah, happily, we appear to have achieved coffee," he said.
"Coffee?" Leonard walked over to the table and pulled a small lever on the device. A light brown foam cascaded into a waiting cup with a noise like a clogged drain.
"Different coffee," he said. "Very fast coffee. I rather think you will like it. I'm calling this the very fast coffee machine."
"And that's today's invention, is it?" said Vetinari.
"Well, yes. It would have been a scale model of a device for reaching the moon and other celestial bodies, but I was thirsty."
"How fortunate." Lord Vetinari carefully removed an experimental pedal-powered shoe-polishing machine from a chair and sat down.
"And I've brought you some more little messages."
Leonard almost clapped his hands.
"Oh, good, and I've finished the other ones you gave me last night."
Lord Vetinari carefully removed a moustache of frothy coffee from his upper lip.
"I beg your—" "All of them? You broke the ciphers on all those messages from Oberwelt?" "Oh, they were quite easy after I'd finished the new device," said Leonard,
rummaging through the piles of paper on a bench and handing the patrician several closely written sheets.
"But once you realize that there are only a limited number of birth dates a person can have, and that people do tend to think the same way, ciphers are really not very hard."
"You mentioned a new device," said the patrician.
"Oh, yes, the thingy. It's all very crude at the moment, but it suffices for these simple codes."
Leonard pulled a sheet off something vaguely rectangular. It seemed to Vetinari to be all wooden wheels and long thin spars, which, he saw when he moved closer, were inscribed thickly with letters and numbers. A number of the wheels were not round, but oval or heart-shaped or some other curious curve. When Leonard turned a handle, the whole thing moved with a complex oiliness quite disquieting in something merely mechanical.
"And what are you calling it?" "Oh, you know me in names, my lord. I think of it as the engine for the neutralizing of information by the generation of miasmic alphabets. But I appreciate that it does not exactly roll off the tongue, and—"
"Yes, Leonard?"
"And it's not wrong, is it, reading other people's messages?"
Vetinari sighed. The worried man in front of him, who was so considerate of life that he carefully dusted around spiders, had once invented a device that fired lead pellets with tremendous speed and force. He thought it would be useful against dangerous animals. He'd designed a thing that could destroy whole mountains. He thought it would be useful in the mining industries. Here was a man who, in his tea break, would doodle an instrument for unthinkable mass destruction in the blank spaces around an exquisite drawing of the fragile beauty of the human smile, with a list of numbered parts. And if you taxed him with it, he'd say,
Ah, but such a thing would make war completely impossible, you see, because no one would dare use it.
Leonard brightened up as the thought apparently struck him.
But on the other hand, the more we know about one another, the more we will learn to understand. Now, you asked me to construct some more ciphers for you. I'm sorry, my lord, but I must have misunderstood your requirements. What was wrong with the first ones I did?
Vetinari sighed. I'm afraid they were unbreakable, Leonard.
But surely...
It's hard to explain, said Vetinari, aware that what to him were the lucid waters of politics were so much mud to Leonard. These new ones you have are merely devilishly difficult.
You specified fiendishly, sir, said Leonard, looking worried.
Oh, yes.
There does not appear to be a common standard for fiends, my lord, but I did some research in the more accessible occult texts, and I believe these ciphers will be considered difficult by more than 96% of fiends.
Good.
They may perhaps verge on the diabolically difficult in places.
That is not a problem. I shall use them forthwith. Leonard still seemed to have something on his mind.
It would still be so easy to make them arch-demonically diff—
But these will suffice, Leonard, said Vetinari.
My lord, Leonard almost wailed, I really cannot guarantee that sufficiently clever people will be unable to read your messages.
Good.
But, my lord, they will know what you are thinking.
Vetinari patted him on the shoulder. No, Leonard, they will merely know what is in my messages.
I really do not understand, my lord.
No, but on the other hand, I cannot make exploding coffee. What would the world be like if we were all alike? Leonard's face clouded for a moment.
I'm not sure, he said. But if you'd like me to work on the problem, I may be able to devise a...
It was merely a figure of speech, Leonard. Vetinari shook his head ruefully. It often seemed to him that Leonard, who had pushed intellect into hitherto undiscovered uplands, had discovered there large and specialized pockets of stupidity. What would be the point of ciphering messages that very clever enemies couldn't break? You'd end up not knowing what they thought you thought they were thinking.
There was one rather strange message from Uberwald, my lord, said Leonard, yesterday morning.
Strange?
It was not ciphered.
Not at all. I thought everyone used codes.
Oh, the sender and recipient are code names, but the message is quite plain. It was a request for information about Commander Vimes, of whom you have often spoken.
Lord Vetinari went quite still.
The return message was mostly clear, too. A certain amount of gossip.
All about Vimes?
Yesterday morning? Before I...
My lord? Tell me, said the patrician. This message from Uberwald, it yields no clue at all to the sender. Sometimes, like a ray of light through clouds, Leonard could be quite perceptive.
You think you might know the originator, my lord?
Oh, in my younger days I spent some time in Uberwald, said the patrician. In those days rich young men from Ankh-Morpork used to go on what we called the Grand Sneer, visiting far-flung countries and cities in order to see at first hand how inferior they were. Or so it seemed, at any rate. Oh, yes, I spent some time in Uberwald. It was not often that Leonard O'Quirm paid attention to what people around him were doing, but he saw the faraway look in Lord Vetinari's eye.
You have fond memories, my lord?
Hmm? Oh, she was a very unusual lady, but, alas, rather older than me, said Vetinari. Much older, I have to say. But it was a long time ago. Life teaches us its small lessons, and we move on. There was that distant look again.
Well, well, well. And no doubt the lady is now dead, said Leonard.
He was not much good at this sort of conversation. Oh, I very much doubt that, said Vetinari. I have no doubt she thrives, he smiled. The world was becoming more interesting.
Tell me, Leonard, he said. Has it ever occurred to you that one day wars will be fought with brains?
Leonard picked up his coffee cup.
Oh, dear, won't that be rather messy, he said.
Vetinari sighed again. Not perhaps as messy as the other sort, he said, trying the coffee. It really was rather good. The ducal coach rolled past the last of the outlying buildings and onto the vast, flat Stowe Plains. Cheery and Detritus had tactfully decided to ride on the top for the morning, leaving the Duke and Duchess alone inside. Skimmer was indulging in some uneasy class solidarity and riding with the servants for a while. "Angua seems to have gone into hiding," said Vimes, watching the cabbage fields pass by.
"Poor girl," said Sybil. "The city's not really the place for her."
"Well, you couldn't winkle carrot out of it with a big pin," said Vimes. "And that's the problem, I suppose."
"Part of the problem," said Sybil.
Vimes nodded. The other part, which no one talked about, was children. Sometimes it seemed to Vimes that everyone knew that Carrot was the true heir to the redundant throne of the city. It just so happened that he didn't want to be. He wanted to be a copper, and everyone went along with the idea. But kingship was a bit like a grand piano. You could put a cover over it, but you could still see what shape it was underneath. Vimes wasn't sure what you got if a human and a werewolf had kids. Possibly you just got someone who had to shave twice a day around full moon and occasionally felt like chasing carts. And when you remembered what some of the city's rulers had been like, a known werewolf as ruler ought to hold no terrors. It was the buggers who looked human all the time that were the problem. That was just his view, though. Other people might see things differently. No wonder she'd gone off to think about things. He realized he was looking unseeing out the window. To take his mind off this, he opened the package of papers that Skimmer had handed him just as he got on the coach. It was called Briefing Material. The man seemed to be an expert on Überwald, and Vimes wondered how many other clerks there were in the patrician's palace, beavering away, becoming experts. He settled down glumly and began to read. The first page showed the crest of the unholy empire that had once ruled most of the huge country. Vimes couldn't recall much about it, except that one of the emperors once had a man's hat nailed to his head for a joke. Überwald seemed to be a big, cold, depressing place, so perhaps people would do anything for a laugh. The crest was altogether too florid for Vimes's taste, and was dominated by a double-headed bat. The first document was entitled The Fat-Bearing Strata of the Schmalzberg Region, the Land of the Fifth Elephant. He knew the legend, of course. There had once been five elephants, not four, standing on the back of Great Atuin, but one had lost its footing or had been shaken loose, and had drifted off into a curved orbit before eventually crashing down a billion tons of enraged pachyderm, with a force that had rocked the entire world and split it up into the continents people knew today. The rocks that fell back had covered and compressed the corpse, and the rest, after millennia of underground cooking and rendering, was fat history. According to legend, gold and iron and all the other metals were also part of the carcass. After all, an elephant big enough to support the world on its back wasn't going to have ordinary bones, was it? The notes in front of him were a little more believable, talking about some unknown catastrophe that had killed millions of the mammoths, bison and giant shrews, and then covered them over, pretty much like the fifth elephant in the story. There were notes about old troll sagas and legends of the dwarfs. Possibly ice had been involved, or a flood. In the case of the trolls, who were believed to be the first species in the world, maybe they'd been there and seen the elephants trumpeting across the sky. The result, anyway, was the same. Everyone, well, everyone except Vimes, knew the best fat came from the Schmalzberg wells and mines. It made the whitest, brightest candles, the creamiest soap, the hottest, cleanest lamp oil. The yellow tallow from Ankh Morpork's boilers didn't come close. Vimes didn't see the point. Gold, now that was important. People died for it. And iron. Ankh Morpork needed iron. Timber, too. Stone, even. Silver, now, was very... He flicked back to a page headed Natural Resources, and under Silver read, Silver has not been mined in Überwald since the diet of bugs in AM 1880, and the possession of the metal is technically illegal. There was no explanation. He made a note to ask Inigo. After all, where you got werewolves, didn't you need silver? And things must have been pretty bad if everyone had to eat insects. Anyway, silver was useful too, but fat was just fat. It was like biscuits or tea or sugar. It was just something that turned up in the cupboard. There was no style to it, no romance. It was stuff in tubs. A note was clipped to the next page. He read, The fifth elephant as a metaphor also appears in the Überwald languages. Depending on context, it can mean a thing that does not exist, as we would say, Clachian mist, a thing that is other than it seems, and a thing that, while unseen, controls events, in the same way that we would use the term eminence grise.
I wouldn't, thought Vimes. I don't use words like that.
Constable Shoe, said Constable Shoe when the door of the bootmaker's factory was opened. Homicide!
You come back, Mr. Sonkey, said the troll who'd opened the door.
Warm, damp air blew out into the street, smelling of incontinent cats and sulphur.
I meant I'm a zombie, said Red Shoe. I find that telling people right away saves embarrassing misunderstandings later on. But coincidentally, yes, we've come about the alleged deceased.
We?
Said the troll, making no comment about Reggie's grey skin and stitch marks.
Didn't hear, Big Jobs.
The troll looked down, not a usual direction in Ankh-Morpork, where people preferred not to see what they were standing in.
Oh,
he said, and took a few steps backwards. Some people said that gnomes were no more belligerent than any other race, and this was true. However, the belligerence was compressed down into a body 6 inches high, and like many things when they are compressed, had an inclination to explode. Constable Swires had been on the force only for a few months, but news had gone around, and already he inspired respect, or at least the bladder trembling terror that can pass for respect on these occasions.
"Don't you stand there gawping! Where's yon stiff?"
said Swires, striding into the factory.
"We put him in de cellar," said the troll. "And now we got half a ton of liquid rubber running to waste. He be livid about that. If he was alive, of course."
"Why's it wasted?" said Reg.
"Gone all thick and manky, hasn't it? I'm going to have to dump it later on, and that's not easy. We were supposed to be dipping a load of ribbed magical delights today, too, but all the ladies felt faint when I hauls him out of the vet, and they went off home."
Red Shoe looked shocked. He was not, for various reasons, a patron of Mr. Sonkey's wares, romance not being a regular feature of the life of the dead. But surely the world of the living had some standards, didn't it?
"You employed ladies here?"
he said. The troll looked surprised.
"Yeah, sure. It's good steady work. They're good workers, too. Always laughing and telling jokes while they're doing the dipping and packing, especially when we're doing the big boys."
The troll sniffed.
"Personally, I don't understand her jokes."
"Them big boys are bloody good value for a penny,"
said Buggy Swires. Reg Shoe stared at his tiny partner. There was just no way that he was going to ask the question, but Swires must have seen his expression.
"After a bit of work with yon scissors, you won't find a better Macintosh in the whole city,"
said the gnome, and laughed nastily. Constable Shoe sighed. He knew that Mr. Vimes had an unofficial policy of getting ethnic minorities into the watch. As a member of the dead community, Red Shoe naturally thought of himself as an ethnic majority. But he wasn't sure this was wise in the case of gnomes, even though there was admittedly no ethnic group that was more minor. They had an inbuilt resistance to rules. This didn't just apply to the law, but to all the invisible rules that most people obeyed unthinkingly, like, do not attempt to eat this giraffe, or do not headbutt people in the ankle just because they won't give you a chip. It was best to think of Constable Swires simply as a small, independent weapon.
"You'd better show us the person who is currently vitally challenged," he said.
They were led downstairs. What was hanging from a beam there would have frightened the life out of anyone who wasn't already a zombie.
"Sorry about that,"
said the troll, pulling it down and tossing it into a corner, where it coiled into a rubbery heap.
"What the hell was it?"
said Constable Swires.
"We had to pull the rubber off of him," said the troll. "Sets quick, see, once you get it out in the air."
"Hey, that's the biggest sonkey I ever saw," chuckled Buggy. "A whole body sonkey. Reckon that's the way he wanted to go."
Reg looked at the corpse. He didn't mind being sent out on murders, even messy ones. The way he saw it, dying was really just a career change. Been there, done that, worn the shroud. And then you got over it and got on with your life. Of course, he knew that many people didn't, for some reason, but he thought of them as not prepared to make the effort. There was a ragged wound in the neck.
"Any next of kin?" he said. "He got a brother in Uberwald. We've sent word," the troll added, "on the clacks. It cost $20. That's murder."
"Can you think of any reason why someone would kill him?"
The troll scratched his head.
"Well, 'cause they wanted him dead, I reckon. That's a good reason."
"And why would anyone want him dead, do you think?"
Red Shoe could be very, very patient.
"Has there been any trouble?"
"Business ain't been so good, I know that."
"Really? I'd have thought you'd be coining money here."
"Oh, yeah, that's what you'd think, but not everything people calls a sonkey is made by us, see? It's to do with us becoming..."
The troll's face screwed up with cerebral effort.
"Generic. Lots of other buggers are jumping up and down on da bandwagon, and they got better plant and new ideas, like making them in cheese and onion flavour, and with bells on and stuff like that. Mr. Sonkey won't have nothing to do with that sort of thing, and that's been costing us sales."
"I can see this would worry him," said Reg, in a keep-on-talking tone of voice.
"He's been locking himself in his office a lot."
"Oh, why's that?"
"He's the boss. You don't ask the boss. But he did say that there was a special job coming up, and that had put us back on our feet."
"Really?"
said Reg, making a mental note.
"What kind of job?"
"Dunno. You don't
ask the boss," said Reg.
"Right.
I suppose no one saw the murder, did they?"
Once again, the troll screwed up its enormous face in thought.
"The murderer? Yeah, and probably Mr. Sonkey."
"Was there a third party?"
"I dunno. I never get invited to them things."
"Apart from Mr. Sonkey and the murderer,"
said Shu, still as patient as the grave,
"was there anyone else here last night?"
"Dunno,"
said the troll.
"Thank you. You've been very helpful,"
said Shu.
"We'll have a look round if you don't mind."
"Sure."
The troll went back to his vat. Red Shu hadn't expected to find anything and was not disappointed. But he was thorough. Zombies usually are. Mr. Vimes had told him never to get too excited about clues, because clues could lead you a dismal dance. They could become a habit. You ended up finding a wooden leg, a silk slipper, and a feather at the scene of a crime, and constructing an elegant theory involving a one-legged ballet dancer and a production of Chicken Lake. The door to the office was open. It was hard to tell if anything had been disturbed. Shu got the impression that the mess was normal. A desk was awash with paperwork, Mr. Sonkey having followed the usual put-it-down-somewhere method of filing. A bench was covered with samples of rubber, bits of sacking, large bottles of chemicals, and some wooden moulds that Reg refrained from looking at too closely.
"Did you hear Constable Littlebottom talking about that museum theft when we came on duty today, Buggy?"
he said, opening a jar of yellow powder and sniffing it.
"No." "I did," said Reg.
He put the lid on the sulphur again and sniffed the air of the factory. It smelled of liquid rubber, which is very much like the smell of incontinent cats.
"And some things stick in the mind," he said. "Special job, eh?"
It was Constable Visit the Infidel with Explanatory Pamphlets week as communications officer, which largely meant looking after the pigeons and keeping an eye on the clacks, with, of course, the assistance of Constable Downspout. Constable Downspout was a gargoyle. When it came to staring fixedly at one thing, you couldn't beat a gargoyle. The gargoyles were getting a lot of employment in the clacks industry. Constable Visit quite enjoyed the pigeons. He sang them hymns. They listened to short homilies, cocking their heads from side to side. After all, he reasoned, had not Bishop Horn preached to the mollusks of the sea? And there was no record of them actually listening, whereas he was certain that the pigeons were taking it in. And they seemed to be interested in his pamphlets on the virtues of Omnianism, admittedly as nesting material at the moment, but this was certainly a good start. A pigeon fluttered in as he was scraping the perches.
"Ah, Zebedina," he said,
lifting her up and removing the message capsule from her leg.
"Well done.
"This is from Constable Shue, and you shall have some corn provided locally by Josiah Frumont and Sons, seed merchants, but ultimately by the grace of Om." There was a whir of wings, and another pigeon settled on the perch. Constable Visit recognised it as Wilhelmina, one of Sergeant Anker's pigeons. He removed the message capsule. The thin paper inside was tightly folded, and on it someone had written, "Captain Carrot, personal." He hesitated, then put the message from Red Shue into the pneumatic tube, and heard the whoosh of the suction as it headed off to the main office. The other one, he decided, required a more careful delivery. Carrot was working in Vimes's office, but, Visit noticed, not at the commander's desk. Instead, he'd set up a folding table in the corner. The tottering piles of paperwork on the desk were slightly less alpine than yesterday. There were even occasional patches of desk top.
"Personal message for you, Captain."
"Thank you."
"And Constable Shue wants a sergeant down at Sonkey's boot factory."
"Did you send the message down to the office?"
"Yes, sir. The pneumatic tube is very useful,"
Visit added dutifully.
"Commander Vimes isn't very keen on it, but I'm sure it will eventually save us time," said Carrot.
He unfolded the note. Visit watched him. Carrot's lips moved slightly as he read.
"Where did the pigeon come from?"
he said at last, screwing up the note.
"It looks pretty worn out, sir. Not from inside the city, I'm sure."
"Ah, right. Thank you."
"Bad news, sir?"
Visit angled.
"Just news, Constable. Don't let me detain you."
"Right, sir."
When the disappointed Visit had gone, Carrot went and looked out of the window. There was a typical Ankh-Morpork street scene outside, although people were trying to separate them. After a few minutes he went back to his table, wrote a short note, put it into one of the little carriers, and sent it away with a hiss of air. A few minutes later, Sergeant Colon came panting along the corridor. Carrot was very keen on modernizing the watch, and in some strange way sending a message via the tube was so much more modern than simply opening the door and shouting, which is what Mr. Vimes did. Carrot gave Colon a bright smile.
"Ah, Fred, everything going well?"
Yes, sir,"
said Fred Colon uncertainly.
"Good. I'm off to see the patrician, Fred. As senior sergeant, you are in charge of the watch until Mr. Vimes gets back."
"Yes, sir, until you get back, you mean?"
"I shall not be coming back, Fred. I am resigning."
The patrician looked at the badge on his desk.
"And well-trained men," Carrot was saying, somewhere in front of him. "After all, a few years ago there were only four of us in the watch, and now it's functioning just like a machine."
"Yes, although bits of it do go boying occasionally," said Lord Vetinari, still staring at the badge. "Could I invite you to reconsider, Captain?"
"I've reconsidered several times, sir, and it's not Captain, sir."
"The watch needs you, Mr. Iron Founderson."
"The watch is bigger than one man, sir,"
said Carrot, still looking straight ahead.
"I'm not sure it's bigger than Sergeant Colon, though."
"People get mistaken about old Fred, sir. He's a man with a solid bottom to his character."
"He's got a solid bottom to his bottom, Mr. Iron Founderson."
"I mean he doesn't flap in an emergency, sir."
"He doesn't do anything in an emergency," said the patrician, "except possibly hide. I might go so far as to say that the man appears to consist of an emergency in his own right."
"My mind is made up, sir."
Lord Vetinari sighed, sat back and stared up at the ceiling for a moment.
"Then all I can do is thank you for your services, Captain, and wish you good luck in your future endeavour. Do you have enough money?"
"I've saved quite a lot, sir."
"Nevertheless, it is a long way to Uberwald."
There was silence.
"Sir?"
"Yes?"
"How did you know?"
"Oh, people measured it years ago. Surveyors and so forth."
"Sir?"
Vetinari sighed.
"I think the term is deduction. Be that as it may, Captain, I am choosing to believe that you are merely taking an extended leave of absence. I understand that you've never taken a holiday while you've been here. I'm sure you're owed a few weeks."
Carrot said nothing.
"And if I was you, I'd begin my search for Sergeant Angua at the Shambling Gate," Vetinari added.
After a while, Carrot said quietly,
"Is that the result of information received, my lord?"
Vetinari smiled a thin little smile.
"No, but Uberwald is going through some troubling times,
and of course she is from one of the aristocratic families. I surmise that she has been called away. Beyond that I cannot be of much help. You will have to follow, as they say, your nose.
No, I think I can find a much more reliable nose than mine, said Carrot.
Good. Lord Vetinari went back to his desk and sat down. I wish you well in your search. Nevertheless, I'm sure we'll be seeing you again. A lot of people here depend on you.
Yes, sir.
Good day to you. When Carrot had gone, Lord Vetinari got up and walked across to the other side of the room, where a map of Uberwald was unrolled on a table. It was quite old, but in recent years any map-makers who had wandered off the beaten track in that country had spent all their time trying to find it again. There were a few rivers, their courses mostly guesswork, and the occasional town, or at least the name of a town, probably put in to save the cartographer the embarrassment of filling his chart with, as they say in the trade, MMBU. Miles and miles of bloody Uberwald. The door opened, and Vetinari's head clerk, Drumknot, eased his way in with the silence of a feather falling in a cathedral.
"A somewhat unexpected development, my lord," he said quietly.
"An uncharacteristic one, certainly," said Vetinari.
"Do you wish me to send a clax to Vimes, sir? He could be back in a day or so."
Vetinari was looking intensely at the blind, blank map. It was, he felt, very much like the future. A few things were outlined, there were some rough guesses, but everything else was waiting to be created.
"Hmm?"
he said.
"Do you wish me to recall Vimes, sir?"
Good heavens, no. Vimes in Uberwald would be more amusing than an amorous armadillo in a bowling alley. And who else could I send? Only Vimes could go to Uberwald.
"But surely this is an emergency, sir?"
"Hmm?"
"What else are we to call it, sir, when a young man of such promise throws away his career for the pursuit of a girl?"
The patrician stroked his beard and smiled at something. There was a line across the map, the progress of the semaphore towers. It was mathematically straight, a statement of intellect in the crowding darkness of miles and miles of bloody Uberwald. "Possibly a bonus," he said. "Uberwald has much to teach us. Fetch me the papers on the werewolf clans, will you? Oh, and although I swore I would never do this, please prepare a message for Sergeant Colon, too. Promotion, alas, beckons."